This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents The Others, Blood on the Stars, Book 13. Written by Jay Allen. Performed by Jeffrey Kafer.
Chapter 1. HWS Hephaestus. Venta Draconis System. Year of Renewal 267. 322 AC. The beam sliced through the vast expanse of dark and frozen space. An electric blue spear speckled along its vast length with bits of swirling black and dark gray. There was an eerie aspect to it, a feeling of coldness despite the massive amounts of energy that drove it, and it brought death in its wake. The extraordinary energy lance was a thing of sinister beauty, possessed of a magnificence that provoked wonder and astonishment for a passing instant at least, before those emotions turned quickly to darkness and terror. The deadly beam continued its way across hundreds of thousands of kilometers of emptiness, and then through the heavily armored hull of the Hegemony Monitor, cutting through deck after deck and leaving fire and death behind it. Heavy alloy plating seemed to offer no more resistance to the weapon's immense power than had the vast emptiness of space. Hephaestus's scanners were going wild, their feedback a flow of indecipherable nonsense, as every attempt to analyze the deadly weapon, to identify the massive energy even then slamming into the ship, was stymied by the indecipherable strangeness of the thing. It was energy, that much was clear. And it put out some kind of radiation as well, but only two conclusions were truly clear in those terrifying moments. First, it was something utterly unlike the weapons the Hegemony ships carried, or anything else the Monitor's crew, or its AIs and their vast petabytes of records and data, had ever encountered. Second, it was the deadliest and most powerful destructive force anyone on Hephaestus, or anywhere in the rest of the Hegemony fleet had ever seen, vastly surpassing the power even of the battleship's great railguns. The beam, no more than 20 centimeters in diameter, cut through the hardened hypersteel hull of the great battleship, and sliced more than a kilometer and a half through, before emerging from the other side, leaving a second gaping wound in the hull. Inside, all along the deadly beam's path, decks were torn open, systems damaged and destroyed, and hundreds of Kriegery crew were killed, sliced apart by the beam itself, incinerated as secondary explosions tore through the guts of the vessel, or taken by the deadly cold and vacuum in compromised compartments, killed before they could even shut helmets or activate emergency life support systems. "Scanner Command, I need something better than you don't know. That thing just tore through the entire ship. What the hell was it?" Kel sat stone still in the center of the Monitor's massive bridge, exerting all his will, backed up by the pompous self-grandeur he'd always accorded himself as a master of the Hegemony, to remain calm, to do what he could, what little he could, to staunch the wave of fear spreading through his flagship. Spreading through the entire fleet. Through his own transfixed mind, too, though, he struggled to deny that last fact, even to himself. "The AIs have no answer, Megaron. The energy readings we're getting, they can't be correct." "Why can't they? Because it's more powerful than anything you've seen before? Have you witnessed everything in the universe, Killeron?" Kel despised sloppy thinking and flawed logic. He was arrogant. Some might even call him insufferable. But at his core, he was a creature of intellect. The beam had cut through one of the Hegemony's grandest and strongest vessels of war with a strength that defied imagining. But it was still only an energy weapon. It could be explained. His people and their machines simply didn't know how. Yet. "Damage reports all decks." Kel almost disciplined the officer for his careless and shoddy logic, but there wasn't time, not then. He had to save his ship. Save his fleet. If there were more enemy ships out there, and he still hadn't been able to get a precise location on any of them, his entire advance force was doomed. His orders were to hold in the system and send a report back to Calphoron if any enemy were contacted. His flagship was gutted. That was certainly contact. And he knew his first and foremost duty. He turned toward the comm station even before he got a response on the damage reports. "All courier ships are to depart at once at maximum thrust. The High Command has to know about this. Transmit all available data to the ships before they enter the tube." Kel's voice was still strong, but it was an illusion. His thoughts were becoming more erratic, the realization that he was very likely facing his death in the coming hours, if not minutes, chipping away at his resolve. "Courier ships acknowledge, Megaron. Damage reports on your screen, Commander." The two responses were almost simultaneous, and it took a second or two for his mind to process both. Then his eyes dropped to his screen, moving slowly over the scrolling reports. He expected the worst, but what he saw was even more terrible. The damage to Hephaestus was vast, probably mortal if his damage control teams didn't pull off a miracle in the next few minutes. Something was still holding Hephaestus together. Amid the internal explosions and rolling power failures, his own continued existence confirmed that. But it wasn't much. His ship was critically damaged, three of its reactors knocked out completely, along with half the transmission lines leading from the fourth. There were widespread malfunctions throughout the ship, and every weapons array he had was down. As if to emphasize the dire nature of the situation, the bridge lights flickered twice, and then a few seconds later they went out for good. The emergency units kicked in almost immediately, not exactly replacing all of the lost illumination, but providing enough light for his officers to run the ship. What was left of it, at least. The battery power would last for a few hours, 4 or 5 at most. But Kel knew deep in his mind and in his rapidly beating heart that Hephaestus's backup power systems would never get the chance to burn through their charge. Kel stared at the readings coming in, and as he did, a thought slowly began to take shape, a conclusion that stripped him of the last of his courage. His ship was as good as dead, one of the grandest warships of the hegemony, gutted by a single shot from the enemy ship still defying his efforts to precisely locate them. He was there to fight, to defend hegemony space. But none of that mattered anymore. It was over, save perhaps for the technicality of actual death, at least for him and for the fleet's flagship. He didn't have to wait long for that verdict to become official. Even as he sat there, transfixed for a moment in the cold shock of his conclusion, he felt the shadow of death closing in around him. He could hear explosions all throughout the massive vessel and moving closer. The air was caustic, tinged with fumes from the fires and the sharp smells of chemicals released from compromised storage facilities. He imagined the hell on the ship's lower decks, the heat and intense radiation, the Kriegeri, hegemony warriors all, his warriors, dying, choking to death as the air became increasingly toxic. Kel was no coward, but in that instant he felt his resolve drain away, his eyes watering as he struggled to deny the death he knew had come for him. He clawed out for hope, anything, even self-delusion was preferable to the dark fear and misery overcoming him. But there was nothing. Nothing but a yawning black pit in front of him, the great cold hands of death reaching for him, taking hold. He snapped down the visor of his helmet, feeling an instant's relief, as cool, pure air flowed into his lungs. But the respite was short-lived. A moment later, the containment on Hephaestus's last reactor ruptured, and the great ship vanished in an instant, transformed for a brief few seconds into something almost like a new star, before it slowly disappeared, leaving only radiation and residual energy readings to show that a 6-kilometer-long warship had once been there. If Kel had been aware, if he'd been granted a few seconds more sentience, he might have considered it a merciful end, a less painful death than fire or suffocation offered, and an escape from a war that could only bring obliteration and despair. But there had been no time, no realization. One instant he was battling against his fear, and then he was gone.
All units, full thrust. Active scanners on maximum power. I want a complete report immediately. I want to know what's going on up there.
Ilias sat in the command chair of the hegemony flagship, the position occupied until recently by Kronos, his friend and immediate superior. Number 8 was still the fleet's overall commander, and the hegemony's effective military leader. But he'd been stuck on Calphron for weeks, immersed in emergency sessions of the council.
Talk,
Ilias thought with caustic derision. Pointless prattle. Between the politically charged inquiries about the failure of the Rim absorption campaign and the likely tsunami of fear-driven arguments and debates about the others and how to meet the possible invasion, he suspected Kronos already missed the relative simplicity of the stress and danger of battle. And we can upgrade that invasion status from possible to actual. Kronos was a true leader, and Ilias missed his superior's presence. Despite the failures in the just-concluded war, there was no one Ilias trusted more with the top command than Kronos, and in the absence of his friend, the responsibility weighed heavily on him. There was enough blame to go around about the results of the war on the Rim. Kronos had failed, certainly as Ilias himself had. The millions of Kriegeri committed to the war had as well, and the Council on Calphron II, which had prevaricated on sending resources to the Rim. Mostly, perhaps, they had all underestimated the humans on the Rim, their numbers, their industry, their capability, and the whole thing had fallen into a deadly cycle. The more the Rim dwellers proved their capabilities and their worth, the more essential it became to make them a part of the hegemony. The greater the losses suffered, the more pressure to show gain for it all, to add the rich industry of the Rim to the hegemony's economic base. The Rim worlds had suffered from the Great Death, certainly, but far less severely than those systems coreward. Underestimating them had been understandable enough, especially when comparing their worlds to the irradiated and damaged planets the hegemony had already reclaimed, but that didn't change reality. None of that mattered now. The others had come and they had to be faced, with whatever force remained. The Rim forces alongside the hegemonies, if Carmesha could somehow achieve that seemingly impossible bit of diplomacy, or without, if need be. Kronos had welcomed Ilias warmly on the commander's return from Confederation captivity. That had been friendship, to a point. But Ilias knew it had been more, that it had come from a place of desperate need, too. Kronos had been desperate for someone to fill his chair, someone he could trust with a fleet. All that remained of ready hegemony military power after the losses suffered on the Rim, as it moved to face the coming onslaught. Someone capable and trustworthy to face the enemy coming from without, while Kronos addressed the fractures and weaknesses from within. Ilias knew Kronos had faith in him, but he had also seen something in his commander's eyes, the doubt about leaving the fleet himself on what seemed likely to be the start of the hegemony's greatest challenge. Kronos had always despised the political maneuvering so prevalent on the Council, but both he and Ilias had realized immediately there was no choice. The hegemony faced the greatest threat in its history, and no one, not the Council, not the military, not the legions of highly ranked masters in the elite think tanks, seemed to know just what to do. More than a century of fear, of preparedness, of shouted warnings were all for naught. The hegemony was in dire peril, weaker than it had been in generations, and the only people it could look to for help had been turned into inveterate enemies by its own actions. The war on the Rim had been a failure. But now Ilias began to see the true scope of the disaster his people had suffered there. He had questioned the order to surrender Colossus, and he'd ached to fight on, to take whatever chance had remained to retake control of the great vessel. He had been ready to send his Kriegery against the borders in a last mad assault, struggling to take the explosives before the Confeds could detonate them. But then Kronos had told him why he'd issued the order, passing on the latest intel he'd received from Akella. Ilias could still remember the feeling, like a cold hand gripping his spine. The others. They were real, and by all accounts, they lived up to the description Ilias had long discounted as exaggeration. They were a deadly danger, validating the fears long fanned by legend and rumor. And they had returned. No doubt remained, no refuge for hope that Armageddon could be averted. Ilias didn't know what he faced, but his concise intellect stripped him of the ability to grasp for pointless shreds of hope. With Colossus, with the power of the Rim aligned alongside the hegemony's own, he dared imagine there would be a real chance of victory against the terrible foe. But his people had lost both of those things. The Rim viewed the hegemony as a hated enemy, and Colossus had been surrendered and left behind. The hegemony had gambled on gaining control of the Rim, and it had lost. It stood alone. Ilias didn't expect the Rim dwellers to return Colossus any time in the foreseeable future, but the fact that the great ship still survived was something. At least he tried to tell himself that. Colossus might still return and join the fight, though only in the seemingly unlikely eventuality the Rim nations could be turned from enemies to allies, convinced to leave behind their rage and their thirst for vengeance for the losses they had suffered, and join with the hegemony against the greater enemy. That task lays heavy on Carmesha's shoulders. Ilias knew Carmesha. She was a master and a distinguished one, though her rank was considerably lower than his own. He considered her to be reasonably competent, if a bit too strident and annoying for his tastes, but he wondered if she was up to the enormous task that had befallen her. If she realized her success or failure might very well determine the future, the survival of the hegemony itself. The Rim dwellers are stubborn. Part of Ilias wanted to look down on his recent adversaries on the Rim, to view them as nothing just the near sight of barbarians, and to despise them anew for allowing petty grudges to blind them to the deadly danger they all faced, the Rim no less than the hegemony if the others could not be stopped. Then he questioned how he would feel if, for all his prized intelligence, he could so easily reverse his attitudes to embrace an invader as an ally, to forgive millions of deaths, to allow the possibility of trusting those you just fought desperately against. Yes, there was danger coming, and a fate far worse than absorption into the hegemony. But how could he expect them to believe that? The Rim lacked any recent experience with the others. The Rim dwellers had no reason to fear the others or to realize that their recent enemies were now their only possible allies, the only hope they had. To them, the dark menace even then moving toward Ilias's fleet would seem a phantom, or more likely, a lie told by those seeking to undermine them. Commander, we are receiving a transmission from Alpina. Alpina? Hephaestus is the fleet flagship. His stomach went cold, tense. On my link, Kelleron, at once. Yes, Commander. A moment later, a voice poured into Ilias's ears. It was familiar. Megaron Hellas was Ilias's colleague, not just a comrade, but one among the minuscule group the normally reclusive master called friends. And the fleet's second in command. Ilias could hear the stress in the officer's voice. No, it was more than stress. It was stark terror.
Ilias, they came out of nowhere. We couldn't even detect them, not until they were right on top of us. We picked up strange readings, spatial anomalies, but nothing useful for targeting. Hephaestus, destroyed. Commander Kell and the entire crew, dead. Jealous and Cormason, too. We're trying to pull back, but...
Ilias winced as Hellas's voice was drowned out by the sounds of explosion. Alpina was a massive ship, one of the hegemony's monitors, the largest warships known, save only for Colossus itself. The great battleships had been built to face the others, and they'd remained in place on the coreward border, even through the war on the Rim. Ilias tried to tell himself he was hearing a transient explosion, a random case of energy feedback. But he'd never been very good at ignoring reality. Alpina was in trouble, bad trouble if the ship's deeply located and heavily armored bridge was taking damage. Monitors had been built for war, and they were designed to be as close to impervious to damage as possible. But as he watched, Ilias knew that wasn't close enough. Hellas, full thrust, all ships, get the hell out of there. Get your fleet back to the tube. It was precisely the kind of pointless speech Ilias despised when he heard it from others. Hellas's ships were clearly already at full thrust, or as close as the damaged vessels could manage. And just as obviously, it wasn't going to be enough. Hegemony's glory scanners were struggling even to detect the attacking ships, but what little data they'd gathered was clear. The immense dark cloud on the display was advancing relentlessly. It was an image of blackness and danger, one that seemed almost to pull his courage and his will from his body as he stared at it. Whatever force was out there, it was pursuing Hellas, and it was going to catch her battered fleet. Not a ship would escape. Ilias knew deep in his gut he was about to watch his friend die. He was about to witness the utter destruction of an entire hegemony fleet. Unless he did something at once. He couldn't stop the disaster unfolding before him, but perhaps he could mitigate its effects. Every urge in his body, every wild thought in his mind screamed out to advance, to plunge into the fight without hesitation, to save Hellas and the thousands of Kriegeri serving in her fleet. Or to die trying. But Ilias did nothing. He said nothing. His discipline slammed down into place, hard, immovable. Hellas's forces were valuable, important to the hegemony's combat readiness. But the fleet he led was vital. It was essential. It represented the bulk of the hegemony's remaining military strength massed together. If it was destroyed, the war was essentially over, almost before it began. If he allowed his fleet to be crushed, the hegemony would fall almost immediately, and any chance, however remote, of coaxing the Rim dwellers to enter the war in time would be lost. The nightmare so long feared had proven to be real, worse even than darkest whispers had made it out to be. Ilias knew his duty, even if it meant watching thousands of comrades and one of his closest friends die. Even if it meant abandoning hegemony worlds and their vast populations to slavery and even genocide. The war just beginning would be fought for nothing less than the survival of humanity itself, and no price would be too high to pay for such a victory. That all made sense. He knew running immediately would be the smart thing, the tactically correct option. But he just couldn't leave Hellas and all her ships and crews. This was not the place for a decisive battle, for the inevitable all-out effort to halt the enemy advance. That would come later. He was going to have to retreat, soon, to pull back before his entire force was trapped. But before that, he was damn sure going to do whatever he had to do to get Hellas's ships, some of them at least, out with him. All vessels maintain forward thrust, but reduced to 30%. Prepare to arm weapons arrays. Chapter 2 Confederation Naval HQ, Troia City, Megara, Oleus 3, Year 322 AC. Congratulations, both of you. I'm sure it sometimes felt like every force in the galaxy was trying to separate you, but in the end, you beat them all. We've had some desperate struggles, all of us. Almost certainly, we'll have challenges tomorrow, more war and hardship, no doubt, and probably a host of things we couldn't predict. But for today, for a few weeks together, try to forget it all. You both made it here, so savor that and enjoy each other. No two people deserve happiness more. And you know that's sincere, that I'm not one for pointless platitudes. Gary Holston stood a meter in front of the wall, wearing an impeccable suit, the gray material so soft, so fine, it served as a de facto reminder that he was one of the wealthiest men in the Confederation, as well as the head of Confed Intelligence. His posture communicated a seemingly contradictory combination of rigid respect and the casual nonchalance of a wealthy and lovable rogue. Tyler Barron smiled, mostly in gratitude and respect for his friend, and perhaps a bit because he'd heard Holston deliver a few platitudes when it served his needs. He didn't have much doubt the magnate and spy had detested such utterances, even as they'd come out of his mouth. But he was damned good at them, nevertheless. Still, Barron knew the words he just heard were sincere. He was just about to respond when Andy beat him to it. Thank you, Gary. I'd wager we might get a few weeks, but I doubt it will be much more than that. There's just too much work to do. Andy LaFarge wore a long and magnificent dress, crafted from a fabric that seemed almost alive with various shades of blue coming to life as the angles of light shifted with her movements. It was an indulgence, more expensive even than Holston's suit, but then Andy was one of the Confederation's wealthiest women, something that still felt very unreal to her. There was more than a little of the orphan prowling the streets of the gut searching for food left in her, and while she found many of her oldest memories painful, she never lost sight of the fact that those very trials had forged her into what she'd become. She owed everything to that skinny little child, crawling through the refuse, human and otherwise, in that miserable industrial hell, and she'd vowed never to forget. I just might pull off a disappearing act if I tried. Almost certainly I could. But this guy would be missed in about 10 seconds, and since I'm stuck with him now, I'll have to make some effort to master that Admiral's wife thing. Holston knew Andy was joking, but he also caught the anxiety in her voice. She loved Tyler Barron, he was sure of that, and Barron was utterly devoted to her. But the Admiral was from the same world he'd come from, that of privilege and power and prestige. Tyler Barron's trust funds and naval commission had practically been waiting for him in the delivery room, while Andy's mother had been fortunate to find a dark corner in an abandoned warehouse to give birth to her daughter. Andy was immensely charming when she wanted to be, and she'd picked up a considerable education over the years. But Holston suspected part of her always felt like an outsider. Barron knew all about Andy's past, of course, but Holston doubted his friend could truly understand what it had been like for her in those days, any more than he could. Andy LaFarge was a force of nature, one who tended to attack problems head-on, usually with considerable aggression. But he knew her role alongside Tyler Barron. The Tyler Barron had always intimidated her on some level, even back to the earliest days of their infatuation. Andy, you're magnificent, almost as a supernova standing next to this grim and drab warrior. That is all the more amazing, perhaps, since I know that you are no less the fighter. I find it hard to believe you would go anywhere entirely unarmed, and yet I am at a loss to imagine where in that astonishing gown you've stashed a weapon. The voice was a new one, distinct, loud, and brimming with confidence. Vian Tullis was not just a military officer and a dear friend. He was the imperator of the Palatian Alliance, the head of state of the Confederation's most important ally. Holston liked to think his intelligence networks had paved the way for the development of Confederation and Alliance cooperation. But in the end, he had to admit, even to himself, that Tyler Barron had carried that load almost alone, beginning with the famous duel between Dauntless, the first Dauntless, and Katrine Regellis's Invictus. The two captains had been enemies then, deadly adversaries, and only Barron of the two had survived the fight. Effective diplomacy was rarely based on such encounters, but the Palatian culture was unique in many ways, and even amid calls for vengeance and reprisal, there had always been a respect among the Palatians, an inner voice that no doubt called to most of them saying, "This man defeated one of your best. Respect him." "You are too kind, Imperator Tullus." Andy smiled sweetly, playing her role perfectly, save, perhaps, for a slight discomfort detectable to those who truly knew her. Holston had been born to vast wealth, and he'd never known a moment of deprivation. He tried to imagine the desperate poverty that had spawned young Andy, but he knew he would never truly understand. "Imperator Tullus, surely we can do better than that for a comrade of such duration and distinction, not to mention a sister, the wife now of my own blood brother. I am Vian to you, Andy, always."
"Thank you again, Vian."
"We are honored to have you come so far, my brother, and so soon after returning home to what I can only imagine is voluminous work." Tyler Baron turned and nodded gently to the Palatian ruler. "Such things can always wait, Tyler, my brother, when more important things call. I would not have missed this for any reason. Indeed, I was nearly astonished when I got word that you were finally moving forward. I have watched with some amusement for years now, as you both executed your intricate dance together, weaving a veil of nonchalance over a relationship all who knew you well could see was resolute and unbreakable." A look of surprise came over Andy's face, but only for an instant. Then she regained her control. "Well, Vian, this one?" She leaned in against Baron's shoulder. "He grows on you given enough time." The Imperator of the Palatian Alliance stood unmoving for an instant. Then he let out a loud and raucous laughter. "Yes, Andy, my sister, I must absolutely agree with you on that. He truly does." Tyler Baron lay in bed, looking out through the gauzy curtains, his eyes catching the first hints of dawn sunlight. The room was beautiful enough, though it bore the signs of hasty repairs. The war was over, at least for the time being, but the work of recovery had just begun. Megara had been invaded and then liberated, two vast campaigns that had left the shining jewel of the Confederation in smoldering ruins. It would be many years, lifetimes, perhaps, before the Confederation capital returned to its former glory. That time period would be shortened, at least, by the fact that only rebuilding was needed. The hegemony forces were powerful, and they had fought like madmen, but they had exercised restraint. If they had truly bombarded Megara and the other worlds they'd occupied, there would be decades of radiation cleansing ahead before talk of new construction could even begin. That was unequivocally a good thing, but it nagged at Baron, too. He'd allowed himself to despise the enemy with good reason. He'd lost friends in the war as well as millions of spacers and marines serving under him. The hegemony had been an invader, and that was enough to inflame the warrior's rage inside him. But he also knew with the hegemony's technological superiority, if they'd have been willing to conduct nuclear bombardments or biological attacks instead of protracted and resource-hogging invasions, they almost certainly could have broken the Confederation. How many billions of deaths could even the most stubborn of government officials, the most intransigent of his officers and spacers, have endured before they had surrendered? How many could he have endured? He liked to consider himself determined. Many called it stubborn, but how much death could he stand? 1 billion? 10 billion? Never surrender was an easy thing to say, but at some point it would have been nothing more than pure evil to allow so many to die with no hope of victory. The hegemony had been driven from the rim, but only because they had held back, declined to use the power that could have given them victory. As much as he despised their culture and hated them for the carnage of the war, some part of his mind told him a truly evil enemy would not have acted in such a way. There was honor of a sort in the way they had conducted themselves, and it grated on Baron. He wanted only to wallow in righteous rage and hatred, and the denial of that simple viewpoint only inflamed the raw wounds in his psyche. "We have to talk, husband dear. You may have too many years of military service under your belt to truly appreciate the decadence and grandeur of sleeping late, but I do not. You're going to have to meet me halfway, at least. I'm not sure just where that is, but it's not dawn, I can tell you that much." He rolled over and pushed the thoughts of hegemony motivations from his mind. He even managed a smile of sorts. "No, no, you're not laying this one on me. I've been lying here, awake, I'll admit, but barely moving, totally silent. If you woke up, that's your deal. If you want to relax and sleep until 11, you're going to have to stop plunging into places like Danith or picking fights with opponents like Ricard Lié. That kind of baggage isn't the best sleep aid." "Well, maybe you're right. At least a little bit." She smiled. But with the war over, we should get some quiet, some calm. Those old ghosts will fade away. Baron could see that she'd tried her best, but also that she didn't believe what she'd said any more than he did. The hegemony had been on the verge of victory even without Colossus. No doubt risking Rogan's marines destroying the great ship would have been difficult, but just maybe they'd have retaken the occupied compartments in time and killed all the boarders before they'd been able to detonate their explosives. And even if Colossus had been lost, Baron was sure the hegemony could have won if they'd pushed hard enough. So what made them retreat? Why were they so concerned about Colossus surviving, concerned enough to surrender the big ship to us, their enemy, rather than seeing risking an attempt to retake it? Baron didn't make a habit of believing things his enemy said, but there was a growing knot in his stomach, a fear that there was another danger, perhaps yet another enemy. As detestable as it was to imagine allying with the hegemony, something inside him, strategic sense, gut instinct, something, was telling him he couldn't ignore the possibility. So what should we do today? How do you want to pretend your mind isn't almost entirely on the hegemony, and on why they did what they did? Sometimes he was sure she could read his mind. He smiled at her. He loved her, respected her. But sometimes he just forgot how damn smart she was. She knew everything as well as he did, and she no doubt harbored the same concerns. I don't think there is anything to do, at least as far as the hegemony goes. I'm worried, yes, but I'm not ready to believe them yet either, and even less so to send our forces coreward to help people we were just fighting. Yes, maybe there is a new threat, or maybe it's all some kind of trap. Perhaps they hope to lure us in, to win an easier victory, and save Colossus in along the way. I think we'll just have to wait and see what happens. He reached out and embraced her. He was happy on some level, more than he'd ever been. But the coldness was there too, an emptiness draining away the joy that should have been unrestrained. He tried to focus on Andi, on his relief that she had survived her mission on Danith, that even as her impulsive and aggressive nature had put her in grave danger, Fortune's grace and her remarkable collection of skills had seen her through it once again. He was happy about that, of course, and deeply grateful to have her back. But as he lay there, all he could think of was the danger lurking out in the shadows, and those he wished were there who weren't. Van Stryker, Sarah Eaton, so many friends and comrades lost over the years of war. He was concerned about the danger that might be coming, certainly, but there was something more this time. He wondered just how much more he could endure, the pain, the death, the suffering. He was only a man, and he knew he had a limit. Even his grandfather's wars, as brutal as they had been, ended. But Baron seemed stuck in an endless series of conflicts, of disasters and blood-soaked battles, one coming right after another. Was that where they were? Not truly at the dawn of peace, but only in a brief respite before more killing, more struggle. He didn't have an answer, but he knew he would push forward, fight for all he held dear, and for the duty that drove him. But he knew he couldn't face the fire forever. No one could. Chapter 3 HWS, Hegemony's Glory. Venta Draconis System. Year of Renewal 267. 322 AC. The port side line will engage thrust at 30% deceleration. Yes, Megaron. Ilias was still, like a seated figure on some grand statue. He was a master of the hegemony, a Megaron, a veteran warrior, and he kept reminding himself of all that, and of the obligation he had to lead the Kriegeri and other lesser humans to set the example with his insight and courage. It was a way to hold back the fear, if not an enormously successful one. Nevertheless, despite his greatest efforts, he couldn't push aside the realization that he was facing a mysterious enemy, one about which he knew almost nothing. One whose power had already been demonstrated with stunning effectiveness. Get Hellas on my channel. Ilias had watched as the advance fleet, the one he'd come to save, the one Hellas now commanded after the death of Kel, its original leader, pulled back in a controlled retreat. In his desperate attempt to latch onto anything positive from what he saw, he grasped at the discipline the fleet displayed, even as disaster overtook them. They had fought grimly all the way as they pulled back, engaging the enemy ships as best they could, even if that had been utterly ineffectively. But whatever he told himself, one thing was utterly clear. The mighty hegemony was facing a far superior enemy, and Ilias had no idea how to defeat them. Any thoughts he'd nursed of fighting it out in Venta Draconis were gone. He'd hesitated giving up, resisted for a while consulting the AI to confirm the population numbers on the system's two planets. But reality had asserted itself with merciless finality. Fighting in Venta Draconis would mean only the almost complete destruction of hegemony military power. He'd watched Hellas's ships struggling to establish scanner locks to hit the enemy's ships that were savaging their formations. For all their efforts, the technology that had long been a source of pride to the hegemony, there were no confirmed hits. None. And certainly no kills. The hegemony fleet wasn't outmatched. It was virtually helpless. All Ilias could do was see that as many ships as possible escaped to bring back the data they'd collected in the hopes that the combined brains of the hegemony's best could devise a way to meet the invaders on something closer to even terms next time. The population numbers, the people he would be leaving behind, were upsetting, and if a fair proportion of the roughly 300 million in the system consisted of defects and low-level arbiter, a not uncommon breakdown so far coreward, where the radiation and biological exchanges during the Great Death had been the most vicious, there were at least 60 million of reasonable rankings, not to mention over 1,000 masters in supervisory positions. Ilias didn't know how the others would deal with captured planets and populations, but what he'd gleaned from the old accounts was far from reassuring. You won't save one of them if you let the fleet be destroyed here. You'll just condemn billions more you might otherwise find a way to defend. His resolve was like iron, but that didn't completely stop the doubts. He could hold his fleet in place, waiting for Hellas's retreating ships to make good their escape, only so long before it was too badly damaged, before its own way out was cut off. He would have to run, soon, and any ships that hadn't managed to complete their pullbacks would be left to the enemy's mercy, just as the two inhabited worlds. Ilias was struggling to adapt to the reality unfolding around him. The war in the Rim had been bloody, brutal, and it had worn heavily on all those who'd fought in it. But the hegemony had been the invader there, and in almost every instance, the superior force. Now he had to adjust to being the weaker side, to watching the stronger enemy advance. He had to think first of preserving his forces, of avoiding total disaster while he probed for any weaknesses, used what advantages his people had. He now held the position the Rim dwellers had, worse even, since the enemy overmatched his forces by a far greater margin than the hegemony had enjoyed over the Rim navies. He had to find ways to counter the deadly threat, to focus on his fleet's strengths, even as those he'd recently fought against had so effectively utilized their bomber wings. The only problem was so far, Ilias hadn't come up with any advantages. His ships could barely track the attackers, and while he couldn't be sure some of Hellas's vessels hadn't scored hits, he had no hard data, no detailed damage reports, no way to make reasonable tactical decisions. No way to even know if a single hegemony ship had done meaningful damage to one of the enemy vessels. Megaron and Hellas on your channel, Commander. He tapped the headset, activating the comm unit. Hellas, you've got to get your ships back faster. We're running out of time. It was blunt, direct, and nothing more than the simple truth. No excuses, he added almost immediately, though he knew Hellas wasn't the type to shift blame. Anything that doesn't make it into the tube in time is... He paused for a second, fairly certain he didn't have to finish what he'd been about to say. I don't care if you need to overload your reactors, burn your engines to cinders or what, but do something. Ilias had seen what the Rim dwellers had managed to do by torturing their equipment, pushing their systems to the brink. He'd also seen them suffer the consequences, ships damaged, even destroyed as systems were pushed too far. He was only halfway to full realization that his people were now in the same situation their former enemies had been in, that they were going to have to take wild risks, think out of the box. Or they were going to lose the war. Badly. And quickly. He had to find a way, some way to stop the enemy or at least delay them. Or they'd be at Kalfaron in a matter of weeks. We've got a lot of damaged hulls, Commander, if we push the engines and reactors too hard. And if you don't, you're all dead. It was brutal, after a fashion, but it was true, and there was no time to argue. Yes, Commander, I will do all I can. See that you do. It was harder edge than he liked, especially for an officer he respected as much as he did Hellas, but it was what she needed to hear then. And Hellas, I want your ships to transmit all your scanner results onto the fleet net at once, and continue to do so as more data comes in. Ilias knew Hellas understood his purpose at once. The most important thing the fleet would bring away from the lost battle was data. Petabytes of information that would hopefully allow the analysts back at Fleet Command to improve on tracking and tactics, to develop ways to more effectively fight the enemy. Because if the Hegemony fleet had to face the others with no better targeting than it was managing in Inventor Traconis, they were finished already. Commander Tragus, engineering reports all batteries back online and ready to fire at full power. Very well, Hectoron. Tie in with most recent scans and open fire. Tragus was a Kriegeri of high rank, and Avia's commander-in-chief. The cruiser was a mid-level vessel, almost insignificant next to the massive monitors and the battleships of the line. But he was young to Commander, very young, and he drew immense pride from his position. His career promised great advancement to come. If you get out of this, that is. The bridge lights dimmed for an instant as the guns fired. He'd cranked all his weapons to maximum power, even beyond maximum. He didn't have any authorization for such an action, and technically he was violating regulations, but one look at the display made it clear enough just how dire a spot the fleet was in. He'd served on the Rim, and he'd seen the enemy there make good use of overpowering weapons. He'd seen the downsides as well on the Rim, and again moments before, when a burnout shut down Avia's entire weapons array. For a few minutes he feared he had knocked his ship out of the fight, but then he got lucky. He felt the relief physically as the report came back to the bridge. The damage was repairable. His engineers had promised him full power in 5 minutes, and in fact they delivered it in less than 3. He would see they received deserved commendations. Again, if any of them made it out of Venta Traconis. His eyes moved back to the display, anxious for the usual readings, news of any hits or even confirmations that Avia's shots had missed their targets. But there was nothing but the same confusing mashup, signals that appeared to be enemy ships, zoning in one instant and out the next, and his own vessel's shots seemingly vanishing as they entered the inner zone around the ghostly and mysterious ships. He'd faced danger before, and fear, even defeat, but the frustration of not even knowing if he was striking against the enemy was almost unbearable. You do know. We're not hitting a thing. Tragus was enough of a veteran to understand the complexities of targeting at the ranges typical in space combat. There was no way his people, or any of the gunnery teams in the fleet, were hitting those ships, not without precise and sustainable scanner locks. The chance of scoring a random hit from more than 100,000 kilometers was so minuscule as to be nearly mathematically indistinguishable from zero. We have to figure out how to get precise locations on these things. His mind raced, even as Avia's guns fired again, almost certainly missing. They're antimatter-powered, almost certainly. That's got to be useful in some way. He realized it was, but not at the immense range between the two forces. If he could get within 10,000 kilometers, and if the enemy didn't have some kind of impenetrable shielding, he might be able to track them that way, get his scanners locked on the radiation signature of their antimatter fuel. Of course, every ship in the fleet, battleships and monitors, as surely as a cruiser like his own, would be blasted to plasma before they got anywhere near that close. Hectoron, I want all scanner arrays programmed to detect any signs of antimatter usage or storage. He could feel the officer about to respond, and he added, Yes, I know we're out too far, but let's see if we can find anything at all. Yes, Commander. In fact, I want a complete analysis of all detectable radiation coming from those ships. I'm talking about every known form, however rare. We might not understand it, but that doesn't mean we can't track it. He felt off balance, as though he was grasping around for any ideas at all, which was exactly what he was doing. But then he realized if the Hegemony did manage to secure the knowledge to successfully target the others, that was exactly how it would happen. It would be a brilliant discovery, and an accident. He sat for a moment, watching the data moving across his screen. Then he saw something. He reached out for his controls to replay what had just come through, but his executive officer beat him to it. Commander, we're detecting radiation levels outside the usual spectrum. The signals are weak, but they're steady. The scanners wouldn't even detect it normally, not this range, but our full band search caught something, barely. Intensify the scan and localize it. Target those signals exclusively. I want a complete analysis, Hectoron, now, from both the AI and the science teams. He winced as the main display showed a bright flash, an incoming shot from the enemy. For an instant he was ready to pat himself on the back for the evasive routine he'd ordered, the maneuver he told himself had saved his ship. But then he saw Pharsalus disappear from the screen. The battleship had been positioned almost directly behind Avia. Whatever his evasion tactics had accomplished, he realized he owed his ship's survival more to its lower status on the enemy's target priority list. The others were going to destroy all the monitors and battleships they could before they started worrying about light cruisers and escorts. Commander, we have a tentative match, not a direct one, but a 94.16 overlay. That was damned close, but Tregis didn't know if it was close enough. There were a lot of forces and types of energy in the universe, and not even hegemony science knew them all. What is the match, Hectoron? Tregis was an experienced commander, but he would be the first to agree that his knowledge of radiation types and intricacies was limited. It's a Sigma-9 wave, Commander, or close to one. Sigma-9? That's not a normal space pattern, Hectoron, it's... His voice slipped into silence, and he paused. One of the background radiation readings from inside the transit tubes, Commander, but we're detecting it in normal space, which may account for the minor variance from standard readings. The AI confirms there are no recorded instances of such a radiation pattern in normal space. Until now. Tregis felt a wave of excitement, and one of foreboding. Just maybe identifying the radiation type would allow him to reprogram Avia scanners, to tighten his ship's target locks. But just how advanced are the others? We barely understand how to use the tubes and they're harnessing energies from alternate space. He tried to disregard the fear, but the coldness in his stomach defied being completely ignored. Tregis didn't know much about the history of the great tubes that made interstellar travel possible, whether they'd been built by those who had founded the Empire, or if even those ancients had simply found them, the bounty of some advanced race that had come before. General consensus held they were Imperial creations, but Tregis had never heard any real evidence to support such a claim. If the others understand the tubes, at least enough to harness the same type of energy used. Hectoron, I want the scanner suite reprogrammed to track the Sigma-9 signals, full power to all dishes, and launch a spread of probes as well, maximum dispersion and 110 power on their scans. Let's see if we're really onto something here. Yes, Commander. Tregis sat quietly, his eyes locked on the data scrolling across his screen, first from the ship's scanners and a few minutes later from the probes. The Sigma-9 pattern, the Sigma-9-like pattern, was there, stronger than it had been in the earlier scans. And right where he expected the closest enemy ship to be. Hectoron, I want all targeting parameters wiped. Reprogram all batteries to lock onto the new energy wave. 1% dispersal pattern, maximum rate of fire. Yes, Commander. Tregis turned toward the main display, watching to see what Avia's scanners continued to detect. Seconds passed by, each one agonizing, almost like a small eternity. He barked out an acknowledgement when the Hectoron reported the targeting routines had been revised. He saw the status lights appear along the top of the screen, too, further confirmation that his new parameters were in place. Then there was nothing, just continued vague and intermittent contacts. Tregis felt disappointment, renewed despair. It had been a guess, he told himself, a flailing effort to find some way to track the deadly enemy. Then he saw it. A reading, fleeting, tenuous at first, but growing in strength as the AI adjusted the scanner wavelengths at a speed no human mind could comprehend. He saw the strange wave appear on the display, growing stronger, and before he even had the chance to order it, his exec added the overlay, a standard Sigma-9 pattern for one of Avia's transits. They were almost identical, he realized, a few seconds before the AI's calculation appeared. 95.2. It was close. Close enough, perhaps, to decide he was seeing some kind of Sigma-9 pattern, but Tregis realized that didn't matter. The science teams could analyze the radiation, decide just what to call it. He was a warrior, not a researcher. He only cared about one thing. Whatever it was damn sure man-made, and he could track it. Hectoron, gunnery is to target that signal. I want maximum rate of fire, full dispersal pattern. He'd found a way to target the enemy ships, maybe, but it was still rough. Even with a burst of shots, it was going to take some luck. But if it worked. All batteries redirecting fire, Commander. Tregis was tense, his body tight, eyes focused on the display. He could see the flashes, his ship's relatively small guns firing at the only contact in range. It was an enemy ship, Tregis was sure of it, even though his rational mind still called it a guess. The target was on a course right past Avia, toward a cluster of battleships and monitors behind. Tregis felt a flash of anger, of wounded pride that the enemy didn't appear to consider his vessel enough of a threat to attack. That's what let us get close enough. He saw more flashes, all around the AI's best guess at the enemy position, and then something different, something that looked very much like one of Avia's shots had connected. Was it possible? Had his ship scored a hit? He stared at the display, waiting for the AI's analysis to answer his question. But the enemy answered it first. Tragus watched in horror as the contact, the enemy vessel he suddenly realized without doubt Avia had hit, changed its thrust vector immediately. The ship was altering its course, and even before the AI recalculated the projected new vector, Tragus knew with cold certainty. His people had scored a hit on their target. And the enemy ship was realigning its course in response. It was repositioning, coming right at Avia. He'd done it. He and his people had managed to successfully target one of the other ships. And now they were going to die for that. Chapter 4 Colossus Lyra System Year 322 AC Commodore Fritz, the surveying teams have been working 12-hour shifts for 2 weeks now. We've simply got to reduce the intensity of the schedule, or we're going to see more accidents, if not a full-scale revolt. It's a miracle we haven't had any fatalities yet, but at this pace it's only a matter of time. Antoine Dennis was about 2 meters from Anya Fritz, standing up to the fearsome engineer with an intensity that told officers who'd served with her that the civilian was utterly fearless. Or that he simply had no idea who he was dealing with. Most likely the latter. Mr. Dennis, I appreciate your efforts and those of your engineering teams, but I can assure you this is not a breakneck pace. Compared to damage control efforts in battle, this is a picnic we've been on, one on a nice sunny day right next to the lake. Fritz's tone was calm, but to those who'd served at her side, the beginnings of the gathering storm were no doubt clearly recognizable. Need I remind you, Commodore, that we are not in battle right now, and neither is the Confederation at war. This is a peacetime operation, and it should be run like one. What do you know of war and peace, Mr. Dennis? What exactly is peace? Were we at war before the hegemony invaded our space, without warning or formal declaration? What security should we read into the enemy's withdrawal? Do you have some guarantee I do not understand, some assurance from the spirits of the universe that the hegemony will not return, that the Union will not strike us while we are still recovering from the last war? You rely heavily on peace to justify a reduction in workload, but you have never seen war yourself, have you, nor considered the price warriors pay when we begin a conflict unprepared? What value do you think I and my people place, can place, on your opinion on such matters? What price are you prepared to pay if we waste time and find ourselves unready for the next struggle when it comes? Will you step forward, be the first to die? Will I look down on your burned and mangled corpse as I have those of so many of my comrades? Anya Fritz knew she should try to hold back, especially with the civilian officials and contractors. But the war was too recent, the losses too fresh. She was stuck there in the Lyra system too, far from a proper base or facilities. She'd foregone any real leave since the end of the war. She'd even missed Tyler Barron and Andy LaFarge's wedding. The fact that she'd been invited had touched her deeply, hitting at emotions most of her engineers would be surprised to learn she possessed. Declining had been like nothing she could easily remember, a painful and melancholy choice that had been no choice at all. Her work on Colossus was simply too vital, and the great ship too far from Megara to justify the time a round trip would have taken. And by God, if I could miss that... This engineer and his lazy-ass crews can keep the hell up with my veterans. It wasn't entirely fair, she knew on some level, to compare Dennis's engineers to her hardened crews, but she didn't care. She shook her head and her eyes met his, almost daring him to counter her response. The workload had been heavy, but Colossus was one of the greatest pieces of technology ever to fall into Confederation hands, and there was no time to waste in deciphering its secrets. She imagined one day revamping the entire lexicon of Confed techs, upgrading warships, factories, information processing, taking the Confederation's civilization centuries forward in a matter of years, all from what her people gleaned from Colossus and its systems. But for the moment all her efforts and those of the thousands of engineers and technicians working with her had failed even to allow the great ship to make a single transit. Colossus was all-powerful, and helpless and vulnerable as well. As long as the ship was so close to immobile, it was vulnerable to a hegemony raid to retake it. Hell, even the Union could have a go at it if their intel had discovered anything material about the great ship. The first 6 months had been spent almost exclusively on checking and maintaining the antimatter storage systems, the very part of Colossus her team had boarded nearly a year before to destroy it. The ship used antimatter for power, and the vessel's tank stored more of the precious material than the Confederation had produced in its entire history. More by orders of magnitude. That was one area where the hegemony had outpaced Confed technology. The Rim Nations all knew how to produce antimatter. That was basic science. The problem was producing the energy the operation required, the vast, unimaginable amounts of energy. Antimatter was still largely an experimental substance in the Confederation, available in minute quantities, useful for research, but not for mass application in drives and weapon systems. The hegemony railguns used antimatter charges, relatively small ones, but still dwarfing any amount the Confederation could produce. But Fritz could only imagine the immense efforts that had been required to produce the quantities of antimatter Colossus utilized. Even for the hegemony, she knew it had to have been a nationwide project. Dennis had remained silent for a moment, clearly intimidated by the fierce engineer. But finally he worked up enough courage to continue his argument. "Commodore Fritz, my people are far from home, and they volunteered to come here to help with your project, but I'm..."
"Help? Were my people helping yours when they were fighting the hegemony forces, struggling to protect as much of the Confederation as they could? Are your engineers not being paid, and well paid, to be here? Listen to me, Mr. Dennis, and listen carefully. I am in charge of this operation, and it will run on the schedule I dictate. Anyone who cannot keep up will suffer the consequences."
"Is that a threat, Commodore?" There was anger in Dennis's tone and astonishment, but mostly fear.
"Yes, Mr. Dennis, that's precisely what it was."
"Up the flow rate, but slowly. I think we might have figured it out, but this thing still gives me the shakes." Eric Calmet was sitting on the massive conduit, a 3-meter-wide pipe stretching across the huge open chamber. Calmet shifted himself slightly, trying to adjust his balance. He was a veteran, one of Commodore Fritz's top engineers. But he had one weakness, and it was eating away at him as he mounted his perch 30 meters above the deck. He was scared of heights. Calmet was usually fearless, the first one to crawl into a damaged compartment, or to brave radiation, fire, or any other danger he encountered in his work. He was no coward, not by any measure. At least not when his feet were on the ground. "We're already at 8.3 gigawatts, Commander, and the feed is only open 30%. Calmet nodded. He was as amazed as any of his team at the sheer amount of energy that coursed through the power arteries of Colossus's systems. He was beyond impressed at the massive ship's technology, and he'd had a dozen epiphanies in the months he'd been prowling around the vast depths of its engineering sections. Colossus was a massive technological windfall, unlike any that had come before, and Calmet was sure it would advance Confederation science a century or more, as soon as he and his people were able to truly figure it out. They'd made some progress, certainly, and they'd hit walls, too. Antimatter was one of those. The awesome power of the high-tech fuel was no surprise, and Colossus held massive stores of it. But producing usable quantities was still a capability out of reach of Confederation technology and engineering, and for all the great ship offered, that mystery wasn't one of them.